Part 2. Sunny Slaughterhouse. After the game, the king and the pawn go into the same box. Italian proverb. 9. Cliff stood at the edge of the ruined city and tried to get his eyes to work right. This world looked strange. Shimmering green and blue halos hovered around the edges of every burned tree and smashed building. The jet scratched across the sky, had its usual twisting helical strands around its hard, ivory, bright core. But there, too, an orange halo framed it, winking with vagrant lights. Okay. Shake the head, blink, repeat. The colored halos dimmed. He made himself breathe long and slow and deep. Acrid smoke tainted the dry air. In the second folk attack, he had gotten hit again. Irma had stitched the wound in his right shoulder, and then he slept. It was strange to sleep for days and nights, though those words meant nothing here, where the ruddy star hung forever in the same spot in the sky. Yet he had slept long, his irked back and aching bones told him. He had come out of it, stiff and dry and jerky, a bit foggy. He watched the Sill deal with their wounded and put out the widespread fires. He had just woken up and now, after a breakfast of odd foods and stale water, felt pretty well. The halos ebbed, faded. With Irma, he stood watching the Sill work. Their lithe bodies slumped and sagged. They were naturally limber, dexterous creatures, but not now. Irma said, "The Skyfish came over this part while you and I were trying to help carry that heavy ammo the Sill used. Blasted everything." He nodded, dimly recalling the fevered hours of carrying heavy cargo on rolling flat cars. Their wooden frame carriers held long cylinders of shaped shells with elementary fuses on the underside. It paid to be careful with them. Hard, dumb, sweaty work it was, while they heard hollow hammer blows rain down like a distant drumming wrath of sky gods. The concussions rolled over them, and he had learned pretty quickly not to look up or back too much, because the occasional orange-hot fragment or buzzing shrapnel came that way. Once he had seen a zigzag tree burst into flame after a sizzling meteor slammed into it. He had helped throw water on it, then dirt when they had to. The burning city took all the reservoir water, and then that ran out too. After they got it put out, the humans went back to hauling ammo. The Sill guns hammered hard, trying to take down the Skyfish. The brown and green football blimps churned across the sky and aimed lasers, antennas, and some kind of fire weapon down on the city. He distracted himself by thinking how the Skyfish could work at all. Its elaborate fins could flare out, capturing wind like a sail, and driving the gas bag forward. He guessed the huge creature could trim on this by shifting mass inside itself, getting a torque about its center of mass to navigate. This can be somewhat like a ship sailing at angles to the wind, tacking with its big side fan fins spread out. It had big eyes and blister pods, maybe evolved from some balloon-like species, a bioengineered creature used to slowly patrol the air above the bowl. He had watched the battle and recalled how this place had been only a short while before. The Sill had their pride, of course. Their first full awake time in this large Sill city, the 5 visiting humans had to be led around, shown the town. They saw ancient majestic buildings of stacked stone, gleaming shiny statues to great dead savants, beautiful swooping curves and ramps and towers, then spindly ceramic bridges over moist green gardens and sprawled homes. They exhausted their reserves of oohs and ahs. It was indeed a fine city of untold ancient origin. Not now. During the battle, at least 5 of the living Skyfish had circled, covering each other against any Sill artillery. When the guns barked up at them, a shower of beams and missiles cascaded down, silencing the crews. The pain beam was terrifying. When it struck, Cliff could see the shocked fear come into the Sill faces. They turned and ran, some snatching at their skins as though they were on fire. At the sensory level, they were. The pain gun was a microwave beam that excited Sill nerves with agonies that made them fall, writhe, scream. It deranged some, who howled and jerked and ran in chaotic bursts. Others had the sense to run steadily out of the beam if they could. The effect was intense, immediate, and ended Syl resistance where the beam struck. The pain projectors were soundless, which made them even more horrifying. These were the standard folk weapon to panic opponents, and they worked their silent terror well. But humans did not feel it at all. Some difference in the neural wiring made them immune. So Cliff, Abby, Terry, Howard, and Irma hauled ammo and tried to stay alive. The skyfish wallowed across the air before the Syl city and brought flame spouts to bear. Some forked down green rays that seared buildings and people alike. The enormous living sky creatures systematically burned along geometric paths, and whole blocks of homes and factories burst into yellow flame. The Syl brought their archaic weaponry to bear and blew shredding blasts into the skyfish underbodies. Once Cliff heard an enormous hollow whoosh that thundered down like a bass note. He and Irma looked up and saw a skyfish belly explode. A huge yellow ball licked around the green skin and trailed up the sides.
"Hydrogen," Irma said brightly. "That's their buoyancy gas."
Howard said, "Helium must not give them enough lift. Tricky."
"Oh, come on. Where would they get helium?"
Another skyfish was floundering now, spewing fluids from multiple wounds, losing altitude, veering erratically. The city below it boiled with flame. The great beast slid down the sky through realms of smoke. Its crash was like a green egg crumbling in slow motion as it burned. The destruction lumbered on amid roars and bangs and the sour stench of flame. Not long after, a nearby explosion Cliff never saw caught him. He took hot fragments in his left side and arm and went down. Then it got all fuzzy, the licking flames filmed over by a gray screen of pain. He recalled seeing the skyfish turn and begin their ascent. They rose quickly, buoyed by the spreading fires below. Someone said the huge blimps would mend and rearm at higher altitude and might come back, and then it all went vague and he fell away into troubled sleep. So now, getting his eyes to see this place right again, it seemed odd to have the big world go rolling along without him. Syls labored nearby and gave the humans no notice whatever. There was a gray silence to their movements, but they kept on stolidly.
"Just like it will keep on after you're dead," Cliff thought. "The wide, busy world of muscle work, weather changing, window washing, future judging, fast, joyous dancing, racing heart and great passion, nose-picking, fun-talking, and bug-swatting. All that will go merrily, yea, merrily along. If these aliens were never aware of your presence, they won't be overwhelmed by your absence. But the same is true of the people you know, too. The world picks up the pace and moves on, eternally."
They were standing apart from the men, Terry, Abby, Howard, at the city's edge. The humans had all slept in a makeshift cave in the surrounding hills to avoid the constant light. Here there were scraps of the lush greenery on the slopes amid the rocky landscape, with some odd trees and big-leafed plants rich in fruit. They were eating some of those, rather bland with lots of pale blue juice. Irma said,
"Quirt looks worn down."
Cliff turned to see the slim alien approach, its usually light-footed stride slow and lame. Quirt's voice was grainy, flat.
"Unto here we came to speak,"
a jerky hand gesture,
"and wish share help."
Quirt's English was still improving, and quite a few of the other Syl had managed to share the language upload and integrator AI. Cliff still found it striking that the astronomer folk had widely distributed, among the hunters, Quirt had said, a software that taught English with a few immersion sleeps. He had seen the squat little machine that learn us, as Quirt said, but had no idea how it really worked. Irma said,
"We can labor beside you."
Quirt's large yellow eyes studied them all in turn.
"Medical we are now at, the dead rot."
"They be many," Irma said.
The Syl had the most trouble with the irregular forms of to be, so they tried to use simple forms.
"I sad before our acts."
"You could not know the folk would exact such a price," Terry said, coming up to the group.
"Many dead have not known before fire on our city."
"You have lost the city, too," Terry said.
"No, Do not hurt for the city. We build again fast.
Quirt paused for a moment, eyes distant, then said,
The city speaks what has happened to us. Everywhere on the bowl, the wounds they show.
Sure, Irma said.
When we have more to say, we rebuild. The city speaks again,
Quirt said. Irma didn't understand, then.
The astronomer folk had apparently hoped the varying species of this area would rally to the folk cause and use the anguish to somehow ensnare Cliff and the others. For the Sill, it had worked in reverse. The Sill had been festering under folk rule for a long time, and had seized the opportunity of uniting with their small human band. Now they suffered for it repeatedly as the folk tried to find the humans.
How long will they bear up? Cliff wondered. We've caused them huge losses.
How we help? Abe asked.
Quirt stood silent as its large eyes elongated up and down rhythmically. The yellow eyes closed and the eyelids vibrated as if shaken from behind. These expressions had no human parallel. Cliff had thought before that this must mean surprise or puzzlement, but now the alien made a curious squatting motion, its sinewy arms knotted in front of it. With the large Sill pancake hands and thick fingers, it shaped a twisting architecture in the air. Then its eyes jerked open and it stood. Cliff was cautious in inferring emotions from facial signatures in the Sill, but this case at least seemed clear. The constricted face oozed sad resolve.
Dead are many. Have time now, little.
Irma said softly, You wish help with the dead?
We may share violence, share our ends also.
The finely tended Sill City was now a chaos of jagged building shells, of splintered statues to great sills now shattered into lumpy gray shards, of cratered streets, of angular trees sheared off at their roots or burned to cinders, of vehicles sitting gnarled and toasted, and the only sounds those of stones falling from half-crumpled walls. No groans anymore. A city of dead. A grim procession clogged the few cleared routes. Sill shuffled along with blackened faces and torn skins, mournful angular faces with eyes that saw little before them. Some of them bore wounded, others bore their dead. None spoke. None needed to. The stench came to Cliff as they strode down from the surrounding hills. It rose as they entered the ruined precincts. Terry made masks for them all that proved essential as they labored through the endless day. There was a code for burying the dead, something to do with recycling their substance into the bowl's sealed ecology. Especially here, water seemed scarce, and the bodies went into a kind of pit that had a flexible blue cover and drains at the bottom. Cliff hated going into the buildings and avoided them. He came upon a big Sill body that had a family gathered around it. They were rolling it in a pale green sheet. They stepped back and looked at Cliff. They were short, thin, and probably could not easily carry the body. He nodded and squatted to pick up the stiff, fragrant mass. He got it standing on the rigid legs, then tipped the body onto his shoulder. As he stood up, the pressure forced gas through the voice box, and a ragged croak rattled out. It sent shivers down his back. For a long second, he wondered if the alien was protesting. He made himself look into the contorted Sill face, gone rigid. A purple tongue stuck out between the small knobby Sill teeth. The eyes had burst, and goo ran down the angular cheeks. Cliff looked away, stopped breathing. He took short, jolting steps, and the family followed him silently all the way to the pit. He was sweating when he edged the body gently into the opening flap. The family just stared at the green sheet as it slid in, murmured to each other, then turned and walked slowly away. No sayings over the body, no ceremony. There was something dignified in the utter lack of ritual. None of the Sill had looked him in the eye. He wondered what that meant. The first day was hardest. After that, a numb resignation set in. The bodies got loaded on wagons and taken to parks. The only large open areas in the city not filled with rubble. Some places the Sill got funeral pyres going, burning the bodies to keep them from stinking and from spreading disease.
Dirt takes not all, Quirt said.
Cliff supposed that meant the soil processors were overloaded by such massive numbers. Many corpses were underground. The job became an elaborate Easter egg hunt, Irma remarked sourly. They would bust into a shelter where often Syl had taken refuge, sitting in orderly rows. The humans were just helpers beside the Syl who would gather up valuables from the Syl laps, where often the dead had held what they felt was most dear. The Syl did not attempt identification anymore. They just turned the valuables over to an escort team. Then Syl would come in with a tubular flamethrower and stand in the door and cremate those sitting rigid inside. Get the precious metals and jewelry out, Cliff supposed, and then burn everybody inside. An alien Belson, he thought, and in the end, our fault. The first bodies the human team had carried out they treated with care and respect, loading them onto stretchers provided to give some semblance of funeral dignity. But after the first day of working on the piles and acres of wrecked bodies, humans and Syl alike became more casual. Bodies got stacked and carried for convenience. After that, a rank callousness descended, and they used racks to group the bodies, then dragged them with electrical haulers like sleds of dead. The Syl called this entire bleak spectacle the elegant stonework buildings smashed and seared brown and hard black, something that sounded like Skleelacroft. But they all spoke little. In answer to questions, Quirt mostly had an eye move that meant yes, or a side nod that meant no. Then came the patient patrols through the gray stone rubble. Here a leg, then an arm. Just pickings at first, parts to bag. But then they hit a treasure vault of tragedy. A reeking hash of 100 had assembled in a basement. Cliff stepped in and found the tiled floor was awash in a still warm broth of rank water and viscera. When the burst water mains had erupted, Cliff deduced some of them had tried to escape through a narrow exit in the back. Their bodies were packed in a tight passageway. The dead did not bear burns. From their stiff, bloated condition, he gathered they had died of the smoke or oxygen loss as the firestorm sucked it all away. Their leader had made it halfway up a ramp, only to be buried halfway up to her neck in a plaster goo and stone chips. She looked delicately young, smooth of skin still, though it was swollen and had begun to pucker with brown and blue welts. He carried her out himself. Humans were bigger and stronger and came from a higher grav world, so they got assigned the harder jobs. When they went into a typical shelter, usually an ordinary basement, it looked to Cliff like a streetcar full of Syl who'd simultaneously had heart failure, just sitting there in their chairs, all dead. A firestorm may occur naturally in forests, but in cities becomes a conflagration attaining such intensity that it creates and sustains its own wind system. Cliff had watched the first stages of it from a distance as wind whirls darted among buildings like dust devils of pure yellow and burnt orange flame. Those danced among tall apartment buildings like eerie flame children having fun. Cliff became used to the hovering ruddy heat that seeped through the clouds still overhead. Smells came rising from the dead and made all the work gangs speed up their work. The bodies were not alike, but strangely specific. Some clutched purses, others wore jewelry, and a few who had prepared for what they thought the worst wore rucksacks full of food. Some of the Syl work teams took these, and Cliff just looked away, not knowing what to say or do or whether to care at all. A young boy Syl had a pet, a four-legged furry thing Cliff had never seen the likes of, still leashed to the boy, eyes still gleaming. They were at their work, doggedly going from apartment to apartment, when a Syl woman suddenly appeared and hurled herself at Cliff. She shouted incoherent abuse and battered at him with tight fists. Another Syl rushed over and pulled her off him. She broke down sobbing, chanting, and was led away. He stood stolidly for a long while, emotions churning. Once some Syl work partners found a small cellar of what seemed to be a wine-like drink. When Cliff passed by them a while later carrying a Syl body, they seemed to be roaring drunk. He saw them later, too, and unlike those teams nearby, were working energetically and maybe even enjoying it. So whatever they drank, it seemed a blessing. It went on, and Cliff stopped even estimating the dead. The number was beyond thousands, and probably in the tens of thousands, and he did not want to think about it anymore.
The fiery death penalty applied to all who happened to be in the undefended city. Babies, old people, the zoo animals. The teams talked less and less, and the work days seemed to go on infinitely, down a dwindling pipe. A day toward the end, when they could see there were few streets left to cover, they were combing the shattered shells of the last buildings. With scarcely a whisper, a flittering craft came over and dropped filmy oval leaflets that drifted down from the sky. The curious script meant nothing to the humans, of course, but Asil read it in broken English. "We destroyed you because you harbored the late invaders. They will damage our fragile eternal paradise and bring disease, unease, and horror to your lot and to all who dwell beneath the perpetual sun in warm mutual company. We struck at the known location of late invaders and those helping them to elude our capture. Destruction of other than targets of high security value was unintended and an unavoidable consequence of the fortunes of safekeeping of our eternal bowl." The Sill became angry when reading these notes. They hurled them to the ground, stomped on them, then others gathered them up and marched off with piles of the filmy sheets. Cliff wondered at this and so followed. The Sill went into their collective lavatory. Since he was in need, he went in and found the propaganda stacked for use in wiping asses. He understood all this emotionally. Gathering up body parts in bushel baskets, helping a sorrowed male Sill dig with hands and shovels where he thought his wife might be. The events blended endlessly.